I want to start by saying it is a joy to be here today, and it's actually a joy to be back. Some of you may have figured out that my family and I were actually, by strange coincidence, here in New York last weekend as well, and we snuck in and came to the service and sat over there and then snuck out afterward. It's very nice as a minister to not have to stay and do all those greeting things. So really enjoyed your hospitality last week and this week, so glad to be here. We'll build a land where we bind up the broken. This is one of my favorite hymns, and it's one that we sang yesterday at the memorial service for a beloved member of my congregation. It was very appropriate because she was a person who had spent a great deal of her 95 years working for justice on a variety of causes. But in the last lines of that hymn, there's a paraphrase of a famous line from the prophet Amos. Let justice roll down like water and peace like an everlasting stream. Those are probably some of the best known words from that particular book, the book of Amos. And I found them comforting. That is until I learned more about them and about the story of this particular prophet, about the story of many prophets, in fact. You see, as someone who was brought up pretty unchurched in my youth, what I knew about prophets was that they were these self-righteous, all-knowing proclaimers who would, you know, rejoice in bringing difficult and doom-filled messages to everyone around them. And what I learned is that actually Amos didn't consider himself a prophet, and in fact, he didn't actually want to be a prophet. When his fellows in 700 BCE labeled him as a seer, he replied, "I am no prophet, nor a prophet's son." Not a prophet or a prophet's son. Would it be better if I was closer to the mic? Am I? Okay, well, we'll just let it go. If you all can't hear me, I can talk louder. But when he was called by others as a seer, he said, "I am not a prophet, nor a prophet's son. I am but a herdsman and a dresser of sycamore trees." Well, those are sort of obscure words, but what he makes clear is he doesn't consider himself a rabble-rouser or an attention-seeker. He's a pretty well-off person for his time and place, but he gets anointed to preach in a community where he was an outsider, required by his faith to bring what he considered an unwelcome message. For me, it is important to consider that he did not want to be a prophet. Now today, has already been mentioned in our candle lighting, you all are about to do something amazing. As a congregation, you're about to enter into a relationship with a new minister, and it's a minister who I'm pretty partial to. This is a guy that, as Michael said, I've known for about a decade and a half, and who I had the privilege of watching come into his first Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. He came in with the same kind of passion and hunger and enthusiasm that I had entered with a few years before. I think he may have come with a little extra trepidation, perhaps, than I had. But this is someone that I went to seminary with, who I entrusted to feed squash to my son when he was only one, who is a role model for my now college-age daughter, and who is someone who has stood up and spoken unpopular truths to others when I have needed them spoken. Michael is many things. He is an artist, a scientist. He's a minister who doesn't need ordination to have that title. And he is a great, loyal friend. He is also the devoted partner to Eric, with whom I have long shared a passion for politics and public policy and good journalism. Now, you might think that it's because of this last fact that I've chosen this morning to speak about the issue of marriage equality for same-sex couples. And that's sort of a yes and no. Yes, because I believe that if you are truly to appreciate the amazing leader that Michael is, you have to understand his leadership in the context of his life as a gay man in a nation that still treats gay men unjustly and often with fear. And no, Because this is an issue that I often address, I consider it to be one of the most important civil rights issues of our times. Unitarian James Luther Adams wrote in the last century, "In the great ages of prophecy, the prophets stood not only on the edge of their own culture, but also before the imminent change and shape of new and better things to come. At times of change and decision, they have seen the crisis as the crisis of an age, and they have felt called to foresee the coming of a new order." As a minister, I see establishing gay marriage rights as an issue of crisis proportion in our age. Over the last year, the congregation that I am privileged to serve has lost a number of beloved couples because they decided it was too dangerous for them, too risky, to live in the state in which I minister, Virginia, and my colleague Amy DeBeck is nodding back there. This is a state that, as of last year, the last election, now has the most punitive laws in the nation restricting gay relationships. 2 summers ago, I sat with a wonderful woman, a talented artist who was dying of cancer, who knew that her family was not going to respect her wishes to allow her partner to stay in the house that they had lived in together. I just got a call on the way up here driving yesterday from her partner. She had, in fact, been evicted from the house 2 weeks before. I have counseled gay couples faced with the loss of visitation rights for the children they love. I have conducted the religious services of marriage for same-sex couples who enter into their commitments with that same great love and yet come out of them without the same rights that heterosexual couples do. I do these things as a straight or not person, as Doug said in his poem, who has a child that I love, who identifies as a lesbian. And I do so also as someone who understands how slippery the rights of marriage can be. I am multiracial and born in 1962, 5 years before the Supreme Court ruled that my parents' marriage was in fact legal in this country. Now, the etymological roots of the word prophecy mean simply to be tied together by a religious vow, and religion at its origins means to be bound together. And so to be prophetic is merely to be called to speak and act because of the beliefs to which one is bound. To ask for peace among peaceniks may not sound like that hard of a thing to do, or to ask for a greater commitment to the earth among environmentalists. But to witness for peace among those whose interests are tied to the war is another thing. And to call for equal marriage rights for all in today's society is sometimes, in my experience, to take the risk of standing alone. About 4 years ago, when the contentious debate began in Virginia, our congregation voted to put up a rainbow banner on the front of our church, which states that we believe in marriage rights for all. This, I believe, was a prophetic act. It tied us to our deep religious beliefs. And since then, we have hosted regional gatherings. We'll host one next weekend. And we've raised the funds to replace the banner twice because these things have a way of walking away in the night. And we've also held public rallies where we've witnessed outside of our church with signs, with candles, in many ways. And last November, after the election, we held an evening vigil to hold the heartbreak of the gay and lesbian, bisexual and transgendered community and many of the straight allies who had also worked hard for the defeat of that awful amendment. We sat together to try to consider and console ourselves and to try to wrestle with the puzzle that our state had just added legislated hate in all places to the Bill of Rights in our Constitution. Now, like Amos, you and I, the ones faced with the need to be the modern-day prophets, may not want the job either. But the fact is, we are experiencing the inconvenient truth of a prophetic call, called to speak upon what we believe as Unitarian Universalists, that the inherent worth and dignity is of all people, and to make our faith real and to let it walk in the world, even when we'd rather do anything else, something else, even maybe be a dresser of sycamore trees, whatever that is. Anything would be easier than bothering others with a message that they may not want to hear, or which may actually make us question our most deeply held assumptions. Being prophetic requires us to risk in order that others may more truly understand fully what our faith compels us to see. To call for prophecy makes us uncomfortable because our realizations about what is right don't come with neon signs that tell us, yes, this is the next social frontier. That's only determined through hindsight. Our movement was far from unanimous when slavery was debated. Initially, only a few saw it as the outgrowth of the liberal religious values of the Unitarians or the Universalists. Most of people thought it was something that was against the economic and social interests of the mainstream, and they just didn't want to talk about it. Prophetic voices make us uncomfortable because they challenge the order in our lives. Unitarians and Universalists were uneasy at first when women began to ask for equality. Today, we're proud to claim the legacy of Olympia Brown and Susan B. Anthony, another who traveled with us, other suffragettes who were in our midst. But in those early centuries, as the children's story reminds us, our liberal religious establishment had a very lukewarm and somewhat hostile response to those early pioneers who were calling for more opportunities for women. In the same way, today, we may want to deny the truths that are all around us, that people we respect and people we love are competent to be in committed and true relationships, and in fact are doing so, and yet are denied the many, many, many rights and privileges that come in our society with marriage. There are literally scores of legal rights that come when a heterosexual couple is married. Patricia Kane of the Santa Clara Law School has a long list, and those are only the ones that are bound up in the Internal Revenue Service Code, the tax advantages that you can get through marriage. But as a result of the fact that we have marriage inequality, bisexual, gay, lesbian, and transgender couples face, among other things, the inability to visit a partner who becomes ill if the family of origin denies the visitation rights, the possibility, and this happened to a couple in our congregation, of being denied access to a child who is in the hospital, the inability to access health care benefits, which we all know are so critical, through their partners, and the inability to transfer property to a spouse upon death, or in states like Virginia, to own property legally together. There's a lot that we need to learn about this, and our congregation has had a very ongoing and fascinating discussion of this using E.J. Graff's book, What is Marriage For? It really talks about the intricate values that are tied up with this institution we call marriage. I am proud of the risks that the congregation I serve has taken. We had a long journey there. It took us, I think it was, more than 12 years to become a welcoming congregation, one designated by the UUA as having done the work that you all have done to look at our unconscious biases. But when you walk into our church today, one of the first things you see nestled among the Jeffersonian architecture is a large collection of books on bisexual, gay, lesbian, and transgendered experiences, which immediately says to people, we mean what we say, we are welcoming. And I truly wish, that we had found our prophetic voice earlier. The poem that I read about by Doug Lloyd is called A Million Votes No. And the reason for that is that that was what we thought we needed to defeat the constitutional amendment we faced. We got close to that million, But the religious right got more than we expected as well. The amendment passed in Virginia due to the advocacy of people like us by a much narrower margin than anyone anticipated. And yet its proponents were already so organized when it was launched. I keep thinking, what would have happened if we had been so organized? I know that the issues that you face in New York are different, but there are issues as right in front of you as well, issues that will come up at some point, and the question will be, will you be ready to have your voice be one of prophecy? Now, I am, as of last week, I don't think I can deny this, had my birthday, turned 45, so I'm a middle-aged woman, heterosexual. I have 2 kids, a dog, 3 elusive fish, and as of last week as well, 2 rescued feeder mice. You know how that is. I'm privileged to already enjoy the benefits of marriage, so in some ways you could say, this is not my story. But it has become my story in the same way that the message that Amos preached became his. Working for a larger cause of equality around marriage has become personal for me because of what I believe and because of whom I love, and it gives me courage to do some things I wouldn't be able to do otherwise. I will continue to try to find my prophetic voice. Sometimes it's a little tremulous, but I have to keep trying to find it because people I love identify as bisexual, as gay, as lesbian, as transgendered. And I want them to have the same advantages that I have, to love whom they love, to commit their lives when they find a partner who increases their life's joy, to have kids as they choose, financial security as they can manage it, the opportunity to work and exist as they are and not in a cloaked identity that saps so much of life and creativity. And in the most important times of joy and grief, when others have the privilege of having their loved ones around them, I want them to have that same care and comfort. I want to share something from my own experience and watching what happens often when people call ministers who, among their many identities, hold an identity of being part of a historically marginalized group. It is sometimes hard for us to know when we should raise these issues, when we should tell these stories. And so sometimes we remain silent because we're afraid of being seen as being a one-issue person. I think you all already know that Michael is not a one-issue person. He is a person with many interests, many talents, and many sources of passion. But I hope you also know that by calling him as your minister, you have an amazing source of wisdom. Not that he is the expert on all things gay, but that he does have a particular experience that can inform. Oh, maybe he is. Did he say he was? No, he might have said he was. Regardless of that, we'll talk about that later, Michael. He does have an amazing experience that is now part of the resource that you have at your disposal as you continue on your prophetic journey. So as I close, I want to invite any of you who are willing to join with me in a litany. It's a litany that we used at our Day of Advocacy that our Gay Straight Alliance hosted last year. Your part is easy. You just have to say, "We stand on the side of love." And that's a phrase that the Reverend Bill Sinkford, the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, used in his statements in support of gay marriage last year. So let's try it together. We stand on the side of love. Because we cannot be silent when rights would be taken, we stand on the side of love. Because we know that democracy is for establishing rights and not denying them, we stand on the side of love. In a world so torn and scarred by hatred, because we know that an attack on love is simply a distraction from other issues that some would have us turn away and not see, we stand on the side of love. Because legislating discrimination is an affront to the traditions of honoring human rights, we stand on the side of love. because we know that this is not an issue just about some. It is an issue for all who would live in a world of justice and decency. We stand on the side of love, and because we know that this world is not just ours. It is the one we bequeath to our children and grandchildren, our nieces and nephews, and generations to come. We stand on the side of love. May we be the ones to make it so. Amen.